serious, man. You cannot be serious!
Now, Don, we won't insult people's intelligence who are listening to this. I have tried to arrange this, but I never know if it's going to happen until the person answers the phone. But I did tell him we were going to ring him. And this is born out of a statement you made last week about, do you think they're trying to, these weren't your words, but dumb cricket down by limiting bounces or dangerous balls in cricket to one or two and over, or even discarding them, disregarding them, cancelling them altogether. And I said to you, did I not, the best person I think to ask would be the great Dennis Keith Lilly. And you all guffawed and said, well, he won't come on. I've rang him earlier in the week and said, could we speak to him? We're not sure that he is going to answer the phone, but he said he would. And you can ask him, along with a whole lot of other things, because I watched an hour-long documentary on him. It was great sporting stars of all various sports. And I watched him, and you just forget just what an impact and how great and how what a figure he was, steaming in with that great bowling action. And I'm not a cricket devotee. But man, what an athlete that man was, who had a chronic back injury, and the Austin Robinson, thank you, Rocket. Austin Robinson Sr. Got him into remedial exercise. He had his back.
Frank Pike, wasn't it?
Well, Frank Pike as well as Austin Robinson Sr. And they put him in a plaster cast for 6 months to try. He bowled. This is extraordinary. This staggered me. In his career, he bowled 45,000 first-class balls. Imagine rolling your arm over at that speed, 155-odd miles an hour, 45,000 times. What toll would that have on you physically? And so he is the great Dennis Lilly. We're going to ring him now, and you can, first up, I'll introduce you, and you can just ask him, do you think they should? I hope this is he. This might be he. This is not he.
Hello.
Hello.
Dennis.
Sam.
Dennis Keith Lilly. This is Sam Newman, and Don Scott is on the other microphone, and we are very grateful. I've given you a very good introduction, Dennis. I'm very grateful that you took our call, and you're in Perth as we speak.
Yes, I am, and it's going to be very hot here, 39. So.
And Dennis,
you're a recluse now. Why are you taking this phone call?
Well, because I know you and you're a mate. The only reason, let me give you the tip.
Now, well, we are very appreciative because we know you. I know you don't do many of these, and this is born out of the fact that Don said they're thinking of restricting bounces and dangerous balls in cricket, and he said, what do you think of that? I said, well, we're dumbing every sport down. I tell you who we should ask, and that's why we are speaking to you, and we appreciate it. So I'll ask you the question now. Don, you said that you were thinking that the cricket authorities are now going to stop one day, not even allowed to be bowled bounces, or beam balls, or whatever you call them. And you said, what do you think of that? And I said, well, we'll ask the great Dennis Lilly. What do you think of that?
I think it's great, Sam. I think they should also, while they're at it, ban the Yorker.
The what? The Yorker?
Maybe ban a down and out swinger. ban off cutter.
You're right.
I mean, this is ridiculous.
So you do think it is ridiculous because... Don made a very good point off air. He said the gladiatorial aspect of what Test cricket used to be with you and Thompson and the great West Indies players, he said it was just must-watch sport, no matter whether you're a devotee of cricket or not. And now it seems to be just on the wane a bit like our Australian rules game for the purists.
Yeah, I think any sport that becomes professional... I think there's a dumbing down in a way, and that's not having there's no criticism. I think what happens is now it's all of a sudden, instead of it being like us dinosaurs when we played, that includes you too, Don. When we played, it was a part time thing. Basically, you had a job, you had to hold down a job, and you played cricket. So I think when it becomes professional, it becomes your job, becomes your life, and your livelihood, and the chance to set yourself up in life as you would in a job situation, then I think it gets a little sort of a bit dumbed down. You don't want to lose your spot. You want to, you know, you want to be in the next, there for the next contract, all that sort of thing. Whereas when we played, you know, you didn't really care if you got $8, you know, a day or not. You know, it was just because you were playing for the love of it. And I'm not saying they don't play for the love of it at all. I know they do. But I think professional sport has it's here, but it has something to answer for in regards to what Don was saying, definitely.
So I think this said here when they unveiled your statue outside the MCG, it said, Dennis Lilly was the most accomplished and consistently hostile fast bowler of his time. At his peak, no one was faster, more competitive, more menacing or resourceful. What I want to ask you, did they cut you some slack when you came out at batting number 9 or 10 in a test match? Did people go easy on you, seeing as you'd probably give them Larry Do when they were in?
I don't think so. I guess a few did. A few that were probably a little bit meek of heart. There was a few of them. But generally, no. The good fast bowlers, you know, there was years ago, there was a sort of a pact, they reckon, that, you know, you don't bowl bouncers to fast bowlers to fast bowlers, tail enders.
Did you follow that pact?
No way. if they could hold a bat, and they looked, you know, as though they're, and you know, they could play a bit. Gee, give them everything. I mean, you know, you want the back of them as soon as you can. They're in the way of you winning.
Yeah, but you could handle yourself with a bat. There was you and Imran Khan. You had a go one day.
Cop plenty. So
yeah, but you could handle yourself with a bat. You were flicking him off your toes around a square leg. I don't know whether you got a four, you know, but you could handle yourself. Some of these other people can't.
Yeah, well, then I'd suggest in the professional world and professional game that their coaches get them in the net and get a soft ball, get a tennis ball, take the fur off it, dip it in water every time and throw hundreds of balls at these blokes so they know they won't get hurt, and B, they can get in line and do whatever they want to do. Ducks, they can hook, they can pull. You know, you've got to learn your trade. You know, in the past, it was just almost given that 9, 10 and Jack, as they called it, you know, might throw the bat a bit and get a few runs. But, you know, we believe that 10, 15, 20-odd runs in a partnership 9, 10, 11 was gold.
So in the nets,
yes.
Were you got, well, not you, but the batsman, you as a bowler, would you bowl bouncers at the batsman so they learnt to get out of the road?
I'd bowl in a practice session, every practice session I bowled as though I was bowling in a match. And whether it was my teammate and he was opening the batting next week or batting number 9 or whatever, he copped whatever I thought I would be bowling to position.
So what I'm
practice as you play.
Okay, so what I'm trying to ask, these blokes cannot get out of, probably they don't do that nowadays, and the batsmen haven't got the ability to read the ball and get out of the road. In other words, it's the batsman's job to evade a rising or a bouncer.
Absolutely. And look, you know, I was out of the game with stress fractures of the back for 18 months, nearly 2 years. And in that time, I came back and decided to play as a batsman. I couldn't bowl. My fractures, we had to let them heal and build up my body again. Well, in that time, I knew I was going to, and I decided I'd try and bat number 5, you know, which was ridiculous. But, you know, I was captain coach, and so I wanted to try and lead the way. Well, I got 5 ducks in 8 innings. And then I consulted an old guy that used to play for the club and for the state, and he was a very good player of the short ball. And he got me in the nets, 15 metres away from me, threw everything he could at me with a tennis ball and those soft sort of balls that you can get for practice. And he threw hundreds of them at me. And he just told me where I was going wrong, how I can fix it. And in that, I gained confidence and ended up scoring, I think as many runs as most of the batsmen in the competition. And that was, because I knew I was going to cop bounces, and I copped a lot of them. But most of them never thought I was going to bowl again, nor did I, nor did the doctors. So here's a time to get me back. So, it was a lot of fun.
So in fairness to what Don said about being able to evade a ball that's bowled pretty quickly, I think you bowling at someone, the batsman had 0.8 of a second to work out whether to duck, hit the ball, or step aside by the time it left your hand. That is pretty pretty exciting, an adrenaline rush if you're a batsman to have just under a second to work out what to do before it hits you in the top of the head on the helmet.
Yeah, look, I think also if I can just get into the psych a bit of a batsman. Nowadays, a batsman from a young age, from as soon as he grabs a bat, he's got a helmet on. They've often got arm guards. They've got protection they want, okay? Now, I can remember when Derek Chadwick, who you may have even played against you guys, Derek Chadwick was a very good state footballer, a very good state cricketer. And I remember him opening the batting against New South Wales. I saw him putting his gear on to go out to face Dave Rennenberg and a few others who were pretty sharp. And all he did was folded a towel over and put it on his thigh. That's all the protection he had. Now, I didn't ever see him get hit. He could duck and weave and he pulled. He'd practiced that every day of his life. He grew up without any. And I think I've got to feel that all this protection, I just think that batsmen will wait that millisecond longer before making a decision, knowing that they really generally can't get hurt. And not many do really get hurt. I know we've had a death, but not many really get badly hurt nowadays.
I think cricket, like other sport, Dennis, is a reflection of society at the moment, and consequently that's what it is. But listen, can I go back and take you back, because I'm going to be self-indulgent here, because I used to follow cricket, and I go back to 1970 when Australia were pathetic and they were looking for a fast bowler. Now, England, there was the Ashes. There were about six tests played. I can tell you exactly where I was, just like when the man walked on the moon. They had John Snow, and Australia just did not have anybody, and I won't embarrass the other fast bowlers that represented Australia then, but your name was up and about as a young bloke in Western Australia, yet you weren't getting a go. Why did it take you so long to be acknowledged? Because I think you, and I can tell you where I was when you played your first game in Adelaide. I was up in the horse paddock. I picked up my car. I actually pulled up before I opened the gate. And I listened to you take about four wickets, I reckon, out of either 10 balls or four runs. And I thought, hallelujah, we've got a fast bowl.
Alan McGilvray?
And it was on the ABC. ABC, it was in my E.H. Holden. And I thought, hallelujah, we've got a fast bowler. Why weren't you given an opportunity earlier?
I'd only played a few games, half a dozen or so games. I'm not sure now, a long time back, but for WA. And look, in that series, Don, you did right, there was a whole lot of fast bowlers that were around Australia at the time that got a game. And I got one in the fifth test. I was about the seventh tried, I think.
That's exactly right. Wrong, but Froggy Thompson, a VFL umpire, was even a fast bowler.
Yeah, Froggy was there. Froggy was an excellent shield bowler, and he just didn't quite get there as a test bowler. They worked him out pretty well, the Poms. You know, they're pretty good at analysing, you know, the game. And they'd worked him out pretty early, but he played most of the tests, I think. And then finally he was dropped when I think even Tony Dell may have come in at the, with me or the last or second last test. We had some fast bowlers around, but we weren't up to the Poms. I guess that's
yeah, but you were the fastest bowler in Australia playing for Western Australia. Yeah. Why didn't you get a go before you did?
I was pretty average. You know, I was all over the shop. I was very fast, but I honestly didn't know much where the ball was going to go. I ran in and smashed it in around about what I hoped was a good length and hoped for the best and trying to bowl an outswinger. But I was all over the shop. So my action was terrible. I had a lot of back problems even when I was young, 19, 20. I wasn't the finished product by any means. And I think they just thought he's not ready. And I probably wasn't. But then I think they were forced into it because they got to the stage where they tried most of the quicks around Australia. Some of the best advice I got very early on was pick for the first test, went to Adelaide. They have a function before at Government House, or it was a tradition. And Bradman was, I think, chairman selectors at the time, and he pulled me aside, and there was a lot of press saying that they picked Lilly because he's the fastest in Australia. They picked him to fight fire with fire, as you mentioned, one of you mentioned about John Snow. Now, what happened was Bradman at that function pulled me aside, took me over and sat me down and just said, look, Dennis, I just want to let you know that that's not all the press is not that what they've said is not right. We didn't pick you to fight fire with fire because of Snowy and their quicks. We picked you because we think you can bowl. And he said, don't get sucked in. Basically, don't get sucked in, which was just amazing advice because I probably would have got sucked in.
And he was a good man, Donald Bradman, for you?
Yeah. I found him terrific. We met on a few occasions, almost always formal. But around his place one time, showed us some old footage of all the old fast bowlers. Great host. I didn't have a lot to do with him, but on the occasions I did, I certainly got something out of it.
Now, I've also got to take my hat off to you because I didn't believe cricketers at that stage were fit. They were just a joke as far as fitness went. And with your back injury, you really had to go back to square one and work on fitness strength as well as technique. I thought your run-up was just the best run-up. I cannot understand why other people haven't emulated what you did. You ran in. Now, I don't know, was it Austin Robinson who taught you to run or Frank Pike?
Austin Robinson Sr., who was the Stalwart Gift guy and played for...
South Melbourne over here.
South Melbourne, yep.
Now,
he was Austin... Sorry, he was Austin Robertson's father.
Father, yeah, that's right. Now, why haven't more players taken on what you did? You emulated running. You didn't drop an arm. You ran with your arms coming across your body, which is the most logical way to run, and just so economical in your action.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was what Austin was saying too when he taught me, and he basically said, efficiency, even when you're running to chase the ball to the boundary, you don't want to be wasting energy, so your energy is being conserved a lot more. He said it will help improve your action, which it did, with a few minor adjustments with Frank Pike. So all those things are positive, and Don. It's interesting, but every time I coach anywhere in the world, I tell them the first thing I say is, you go and get yourself a private running coach and learn how to run properly. And at MRF...
What is that?
Madras Rubber Factory. That was a foundation I set up over in India for a big company over there, MRF. They're called Madras Rubber Factory. And the first thing I got there was a professional running coach. Because they couldn't run.
Okay, so would you classify yourself as the fittest player back in those days? Or were you the first to do weights and strengthen the core and all of that stuff before anyone else?
Yeah, I think there were some players as fit as me around at the time. There was guys that ran a lot. And so I guess leg-wise they were fit. There were probably some as strong. I did a lot of every year I tested myself at the university under Frank Pike. And the aim was that each year you improve something with your endurance, something with your strength, and something with your flexibility. And so that was my aim each year when I was tested each year to do that, and did over sort of 14 years or whatever, or 12 years that I was under Frank. I did improve in those areas. So I think that's what you've got to set yourself. You've got to be really almost as fit to be a fast bowler, I think, if you're going to have a long run and you know, play 10, 11 months a year, you've really got to be almost as fit as a mobile Australian rules footballer.
So the great testament to your resolve, if you like, is the fact that by the time you retired, you held the then world record for the number of wickets taken, 355, and you proved without a doubt that it's a physical game, but the mental and spiritual side of sport to overcome 18 months out with your back in plaster is an extraordinary feat that I think people just either overlook or underestimate or just forget just what you went through to achieve that. Dennis.
Yeah, well, look, Sam, at the time, it's interesting, I didn't think in those terms. At the time, I just wanted to play cricket again if I could. I was told by the doctors that I'd probably never bowl again, and if I did, it certainly wouldn't bowl fast. Because the only reason was that there'd never been a diagnosis of stress fractures recorded before in fast bowlers. So they were flying blind, basically. So my thought was I wanted to play cricket again at any level, and if I could only bowl off spinners, so be it. And so that was my motivation to try and get back and play again. I didn't know, I hoped, but I didn't know whether I'd ever bowl fast again. And really, it's guys that would support people around, you know, that you know, if I didn't have that the direction, I couldn't have done the work to get back again. So there's a lot of people involved.
So what balls did you develop when you said earlier all you were, you just throw it down and rely on sheer speed? What balls and how many balls did you have in your repertoire?
At the end,
I'm sorry, after you came back from your back injury. Sure. You were a much better bowler.
Yeah. So what happened was, I suppose I knew that I'd have one or two quick balls up my sleeve and over if I needed them. But by and large, I was going to be probably bowling, you know, around the 145-ish most of the time, maybe a bit more, maybe 150. The 160s that I had bowled when I was much younger, they were going to be occasional. You know, obviously, as a fast bowler, you love to see that apprehension on a batsman's face, which inspires you, by the way. So you wanted that one up your sleeve. So I always had that one back there, and the batsmen around the world knew that. So that was a massive advantage. But in between times, I made sure that I developed my outswinger so that I could bowl an outswinger at will, which, you know, is a terrific ball for anyone. And if you look at some of the old footage, you notice that, you know, instead of two or three slips, I would often have five slips and even a couple of gullies. So that was my main mode of operation, was to try and get them to sort of nick the moving outswinger. So outswinger, faster one. A bouncer, had a good bouncer. I didn't have a great Yorker. I could angle a ball in, and I used the crease to create different angles with different balls. So outswinger from out wide, in slanter from out wide, around the wicket. I developed a slower ball. I bowled. In the end, I talked to John Snow, who was a master of bowling a leg cutter, and he gave me the secret of how to bowl it, and that took me 3 or 4 years to develop in the nets till I was good enough to use it in the game. And I used that a lot towards the end, when the shine had gone off the ball and when the wicket's dead and when there's not much happening there. The leg cutter was one that sometimes gripped and straightened and sometimes just kept curving in towards the stumps. So they're the ones that I sort of, I guess I can remember. I'm not sure that it's them. You don't need too many more than that.
No, you had eight. That's eight balls. What about reverse? Well, you didn't do anything reverse swing, or is that later on?
That came later on. Funny you should bring that up. I distinctly remember in Melbourne one time, and Mick Malone, I was bowling with Mick, and Mick, the ball was old, and Mick said to me, he said, Dennis, he said, just, I don't know what's going on. He said, I'm holding the ball for an outswinger, shine on the right side, on the right side for an outswinger. He said, and it's ducking in. It's going Irish. And that's the first time I'd heard it said. And so I went to the other end, and when I got the ball, and I held it for an outswinger, shine the right side for an outswinger, and the same thing happened. So what I did, which then, was I changed it, the swing around, and held it for the shine on towards the slips so that it would go for an in-swinger, and it started to dart out a bit. But it didn't go much. But I persevered with that because I thought the outswinger was a better ball. But later on, and I didn't ever use it really for an in-swinger, so, you know, that was developed later. And they also changed their action to a bit more round arm to get that sharp, late swing with the old ball.
So we presume, just a minute, Donald. Please.
It just happened, and we didn't know why it happened. We did play around in the nets and try and get it to go, but it occasionally happened, and we didn't look for it. But we really didn't know what caused it either.
So Don has stood opposite his combatant at a grand final on the MCG. Could you tell us the adrenaline rush that consumed your body when you lined up to bowl the first ball at a Boxing Day test, knowing that they were at your mercy almost, and you got 100,000 people? People would just love to know what goes through your mind and what you felt at that moment, being the supreme number one bowler in the business.
Obviously very exciting. You know, the crowd would sort of start chanting and stuff like that. So it was a great feeling that, you know, all those people were behind you. But, you know, the raw fact is that you just got to make sure you try and get your first ball quick and in a spot that you want it to be in. So whether it be fairly full or just short of a length or wherever, you wanted them to play the opening batsman facing to you, up to you, to actually have to play the first ball. That was the objective. It was an exciting feeling. And it was exciting for the first over, and then after that it became just hard work. it's a great rush. You don't think much of it at the time, really. It just seemed that was what has gone on for 100 years. You know, you never thought that it was much different, really, to tell you the truth.
One man that I had great empathy for, and I think he must have shit himself, was a bloke called Colin Cowdery, who came out and faced you and Thompson, Boxing Day test, a hot day at the MCG. I felt so sorry for that man. I thought he was so far out of his depth.
But courageous.
Yeah. Oh, courageous. Look, no doubt about it. You can't take that away from him. Courageous. Stepped off a plane within 3 or 4 days facing the fastest combination in the world at the time. Now, there's a story behind that if you'd like to hear it.
Go.
So what happens is Lord Ted Dexter is chairman of selectors at the time. The story goes they lost a player injury, and so Lord Ted's rung up his mate Colin Cowdery, Sir Colin, at home in the middle of winter, sitting in front of a log fire with a port and a cigar. or a pipe, as the story goes. And it is a true story. And he's just sitting there in his dressing gown listening to England being battered. And Ted rings him up and said, Sir Colin, he said, would you fancy a trip to Australia? And Colin said, oh, yes, Australia, get out of this, this cold. And he said, it's driving me mad. He said, yes, what, assistant manager, batting coach, what are you thinking? He said, no, play. So Sir Colin spluttered, dropped his port and said, I'll have to ring you back. So that's how it actually happened.
Yeah, but he's got to face you two bastards going at a million miles an hour. He had no idea what was happening.
No, it was, in a way, it was cruel.
It was.
To send him out there at 41, 42, having not played probably for 3 or 4 years, certainly having not played against, two mad quicks on the whacker. You know what I mean?
It's extraordinary.
It was extraordinary. I agree, it was extraordinary.
But I tell you what.
But a great bloke.
And you could not get more courage. That is the epitome of courage, willing yourself to do something against your better judgment.
Absolutely. I don't think there was any helmets then.
There wasn't.
But he had a bit of a mattress.
Yeah, he had a fat gut. Yeah.
No. It was. No, he did have some protection around the rib cage.
He had actually a mattress around there, Don.
Now, listen, you're into. Hey, now, listen, have you put a lock on your wine cellar?
It's now a fingerprint job to get in.
Well, I heard a bloke got in over there. You weren't at home and he was pissed when you came home and you've had to put a lock on it.
Yeah, right.
And who was the bloke that was pissed? Who was the bloke who was pissed?
Named Mark.
Yes, exactly.
So he's talking, making noises now that he can't wait for the borders to be open because he wants to get in the cellar. But I've informed him it's fingerprint now. You'll have to cut my finger off.
Now, Dennis, Don made a remarkable statement earlier. I said to Dennis, among other things, has advertised steel blue boots.
Yes, Don, wearing them right now, actually.
Don wears them as a fashion accessory over here with a suit when he goes out to a function.
I love it.
He does.
I've got a blue pair.
Well, they're called steel perfect. Blue, Don.
Blue.
I'm wheat at the moment, Don.
You what?
So, mine's wheat.
Wheat. Oh yes, yeah.
But I haven't got a suit on with it. pair of shorts.
Now, just quickly, Dennis. I would be remiss if I just didn't ask you. Did you meet? You obviously did. You met the great Kerry Packer, and are you still a devotee of the game? Does it still get you up and about? And just quickly, something about Kerry Packer, who did revolutionise, whether you think it's good or bad, I'm sure we all think it's good. What about that man for the cricket historian?
Made a change the game forever and for the good. He was a very smart man. He was a very dedicated to helping the cricket cause, no doubt about that. He was also helping his own cause, but he really went to bat for us. I'm actually just reading a book again on him, and just funny enough, I've just brought it down with me to read, and it's written by a guy Forsyth, I think his name is, and it's quite an interesting book for people who want to if they want to go back and relive it. I just wanted to see. That I didn't miss anything there. And it's interesting. I had so many meetings with him and I can't fault him. A story about him.
Yes.
Okay, there's many of them. One that really is the man and sort of really shows what he is. I'll never forget that we were at VFL Park and we'd gone out to bowl. So you run out on the field. The umpires are out there before you. They drop the ball, which is tradition. Someone runs up from the team as we walk out, grabs the ball, starts throwing it around. That happened, and all of a sudden, the clouds were around and the heavens opened up. We just ran off the field, including the umpires, back to the change rooms, joking and carrying on in there. And all of a sudden, Kerry was at dinner with Alan Aylett upstairs and came down, ran down the stairs, from a four or five levels, whatever it was. He ran out on the field in his suit, soaking wet, got soaked, grabbed the ball, brought it in, and you could hear this clobbing right just past where our dressing room was to the umpire's room, which was just across the corridor. Well, he went in there and said, "You two bloody idiots," he said, "you know what this is? This is a cricket ball worth $100. It's a test cricket ball. They cost $100. Any of you leave one out there in the rain to ruin it again, and you will never ever umpire in World Series cricket."
Now talking,
I mean, amazing stuff. It just it's all about doing the right thing, really.
Mind the pennies; the pounds will look after themselves.
Yep. You're talking about balls, and I know you haven't used them: the white, the red, and the pink.
Yes.
Go.
I've used white.
Yep.
The red ball is one, obviously, that, you know, has been historically used. And funny enough, that's never, I don't think the size or the weight of that has changed in the whole history of the game. It may have, I may be wrong. Things that have changed are the bat, the stumps, and of course, protective clothing. So... What about the poor bowler? Now they want to take away the bouncer. Sorry, that's a long way of getting around to what we first spoke about, and I probably didn't answer your question properly. What was it? Sorry.
About the ball. You've got the red ball, the white ball, and the pink ball now.
Okay, well, the white ball was started by Packer, and, of course, you know, you couldn't make a white ball that lasted. So what they would do with us is they, after a 10 or 12 or whatever overs, they take them off the field, someone would take, and they re-coat them or paint them up again. Never the same, of course, but at least it was, it, instead of them being that browny, dirty colour, which they became, they've obviously remedied that now, they had to actually paint the thing with a white paint to bring them up so the batsman could see them. Interesting.
So,
but pink never.
So if anyone is listening to this, Dennis, and taking note of the great DK Lilly, you would say, I'm not putting words in your mouth, but you would say, don't tamper around with the game too much. The weapon of the fast bowler is to try and intimidate. You've got that much padding and enough padding to be able to withstand short balls. Just leave it alone and don't dumb it down too much in this woke and politically correct society we are part of.
Absolutely, and, you know, if the batsman's having trouble with the bouncer, go in the net. You're a professional, go in the net.
Now, can
check
you
your
ask...
technique. Check your technique.
Finally, Donald.
One last question. Why, and it just amazes me, in Australia, the last captain who was a bowler, to my knowledge, was Richie Beno. Now, bowlers think a lot about the game. Why hasn't it been acknowledged as far as captaincy is concerned in Australia, whereas overseas there are fast bowlers and bowlers made captains of their respective teams?
It's a very good point. I think one of the major things that they say and is that it's hard, you know, when you're tired and you know, the game's flat and the wicket's not doing that, and you're bowling, you know, a lot of overs. The reasoning is it's very hard to concentrate on captaining. I don't agree with that. I mean, I captain coached in great cricket for 12 years, and I didn't find it too taxing. I really loved it, enjoyed it. I think a fast bowler, as long as he's got good cricket now, I think there's no reason at all why he shouldn't be captain. And I would put my bit in here and say that Pat Cummins would make a great captain.
He's just such a lovely.
Well, he's a lovely guy. He's done it the hard way. He's come through adversity. He's the greatest fast bowler around at the moment, and will go in history probably as one of the great, if not the greatest of all time. I just think he's amazing. And he would make a great captain, I'm sure, because if he wanted something done, I'm sure leading by his example as he does, then guys would find it hard to resist.
Are you saying he should be the next Test captain?
I would I would put him in the mix, and I think that he would be a very, very good captain, and so should be well and truly considered.
What would you do with Mitchell Starc to get more out of him?
I haven't seen much of him at the moment.
Well, you're sitting on the fence.
You know, no, I haven't. the only thing that I would think is that he seemed to me at one stage there when I saw some wayward bowling, and I think it was one of the one days, he seemed to be pulling his right arm, his leading arm, pulling it away a bit towards, say, leg slip area instead of down towards the target. The idea of bowling fast and bowling straight is really to make sure everything, your body, everything with your body is going towards the target. And that's something I teach, and I think it's obviously an essential for me.
Now, DK Lilly, AM,
yes.
MBE, Australian Test Team of the Century, who put an exclamation on his cricket career by taking the last ball he ever bowled in a test, took a wicket with it. An Australian legend and icon, and we appreciate you speaking to us on You Cannot Be Serious. You're a very great man.
Well, thanks, Sam and Don. Obviously, I followed your careers too, so but I'm not going to blow too much wind into your in here because you already know you're good. But thank you for that rap. And look, it was most enjoyable. I really don't do many, as I said, at all.
Why don't
and
you?
Most of my don't. Well, I just don't like talking too much about the past. But
you've got the
best out of me.
Yeah, I know.
Come to the microphone, Don. Speak.
You've got a lot to share. I learned a lot from you on that occasion, and other people. You've got a lot to impart.
Well, maybe we do this again if there's a good response to it. If you two listeners ring up.
We get 60,000 a week.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, look, maybe somewhere down the track, if something interesting is on, I'll have a look at it again.
Good on you, mate. All the best. Thank you so much.
Guys.
Catch ya.
Thanks for a great interview.
Bye.
Around the streets late at night, I'm worried because you ain't treating me right. Come back again, I'm just crazy about you, babe.